So it's good to see you. We do have visitors with us. You know, it is always a special.
Are you talking?
It is a special privilege. Man, I hope I don't snore. I hope I don't fall asleep on myself. This would be embarrassing. You guys are really, hear a lot of weird things. So it's so good to have you, though. Happy that you're here. You know, that's one of the things we really emphasize quite a bit when we have an assembly, is that we are blessed to have visitors to come our way, and we mean that. No places or people need to be mentioned, but you've probably been out and about before traveling and stopped in to worship somewhere or stopped in for a Bible study somewhere, and it's almost as if you didn't exist. And you remember that. You remember that. But you also remember the ones that whenever you stop in, they make you feel welcome and make you feel at home.
Like family.
Like family. And you're certainly a part of the Lord's church. You are family. And we're glad that you're here. We're studying this book, The Eternal Kingdom. First of all, does everybody have a copy? Is there anyone that needs to see a copy of this so we can be on the same page literally tonight? Okay. We studied thus far in our lesson. Let's see here. We have seen where the church indeed did get off course. We were told this when we look in the scriptures. The Apostle Paul in his letters to Timothy makes this abundantly clear that there's going to be a departure. Paul in his letter to the saints in Thessalonica makes it very clear there's going to be a departure. When Paul was discussing the role with the responsibility, the duties of the elders there at Ephesus on that little island of Miletus in Acts chapter 20, vicious wolves will enter into the church and they will lead souls astray. So we see this, and this is happening right before our very eyes. We see this with regards to the organization of the church. It would go to a monarchical system with regards to a bishop overseeing other bishops. We see this with regards to doctrine. Original sin began to make its way to the forefront. It began, and it's documented by church historians, where original sin began just as an opinion of a man. And all of a sudden, before you know it, it becomes the belief, the modern day belief of their day, of their age, of their time. And of course, with that, logically, they would jump to the next step. Well, if there's original sin, guess what we have to do with babies?
Baptize.
We've got to start baptizing them, right? So then all of a sudden, now you begin to see infant baptism making its way into the church. Religious holidays begin to make their way into the church, such as Easter for one. Then we begin to see Rome and Constantinople. There is two places of power within the church that are competing for power and strength. And that's basically what we're going to look at tonight, because we are making a segue into the battle of the bishops. And it was obvious in our studies that it was becoming obvious that Rome and Constantinople, they were opponents. Now, some of the stuff we're going to read, they're lobbing, I wouldn't say insults, but very heavy-handed words back and forth towards one another with regards to who has the most power and where people should look to for admiration. And we'll look at some of the comments that are made here tonight, but that's becoming very apparent. According to our author on page 141, there were some contributing factors that made or helped Rome excel, because it's almost as if you were to take a survey on the streets, well, where do you think the powers should rest and be vested with? Rome or Constantinople? And a lot of people were saying, well, Rome, of course. Here's some of the reasons, and we discussed this with regards to prestige. You know, it's just, you know, it's just, have you ever been to Rome? Oh, once you go there, you'll know that's the place that, with regards to God's stamp of approval, that's God's place. That's God's country. Then all of a sudden, reputation. You know, we'll look at something tonight with regards to apostolic authority, where the apostolic card will be played, where people are trying to figure out, well, whose side do we lean on or look to for power, Constantinople or Rome? And, well, you do know that that's the church that Peter established, right? You do know that, right? And Paul was there too. So they're playing that card. And then it's the mother church with regards to mission work. And we'll look at some other things here tonight as well. According to our author, Leo I, a Roman bishop soon to be viewed as Rome's first pope, was successor of Peter, and he was possessing to have the same powers that Christ gave to Peter. That's what he's saying. Hey, look, the same powers that Christ gave to Peter, I've got them. I am a man of authority, and what I say goes. Now, tonight, we're going to begin to look at the various councils that are held. And you might begin to notice by the time we get to the 9th century and beyond, those councils begin to diminish. You're not seeing them as often as what you used to. There's a reason for this, and it's because of bullet number 3. We'll discuss that. But keep that in the back of your minds, because you know, what's happening? Well, why are these meetings, these gatherings, beginning to dwindle away? What is going on? Just to give you a little bit of a hint, what can you tell me about the Pope today? Is he a man of authority in the Catholic Church or not?
Singular authority.
What he says goes. Now, Raymond, if what he says goes, why are we even going to have a meeting for him? Now you think about it. I'm just kind of leading the witness a little bit. But that's what's happening here, is these councils, these meetings that where bishops were coming together, they began to basically just say, what's the point? What's the purpose? If what this man says is divine, and we don't have a voice, we don't have a vote, his is the loudest voice in the room, why in the world are we even gathering? What's the point? So we'll discuss that. So up to this point, we're going to start reading here in just a moment, because I want you to turn in your books to page 142. Up to this point, do you have any comments, remarks that you want to make before we go ahead and shift gears and begin reading and begin to see this, the battle of the bishops? Sounds like a Monopoly or board game, doesn't it? You know, the battle of the bishops. Okay. All right. Okay, let's go ahead and let's begin reading. Let's start on 142 and page 142. And let's just make our way all the way to 144. We'll just go ahead and finish this section out. Just give me a second to get there myself. You see where it says it looked as though this favorable position? Let's have someone to read just two paragraphs here of this. Dan, you got it? Go ahead.
It looked as though this favorable position concerning Rome would be all that was needed to give the Roman bishop recognition as head of the church. Conditions developed in Constantinople, however, that delayed such recognition, and for a time it looked as though the bishop of Constantinople would receive this honor instead of the Roman bishop. In 527, the Emperor Justinian gave the bishop of Constantinople the title of Ecumenical.
Ecumenical? That's okay.
And the succeeding bishop tried to hold on to this title. John the Faster, as late as 588, claimed he was world bishop and that this honor belonged only to Constantinople. The bishops of Rome denied all of these assertions, and circumstances soon favored their position. The claims of apostolic succession themselves soon favored the prominence of the Roman bishop. As early as the 3rd century, the bishops everywhere were looked upon as successors of the apostles. As Rome was the only church in the West whose origin was ascribed to Peter, the Roman bishop considered himself a successor of Peter and vicegerent of God.
Okay, so let's just go ahead and stop here for a moment. So as we're looking at this, guys, so again, it's not just that Roman emperors are saying, I'm going to put all my money behind the Pope in Rome. Because you see here in this second paragraph where you have emperors saying no, such as Justinian, who's saying no, I'm looking to the bishop at Constantinople. And John the Faster was another one. Now, these guys are going to have to make a case as to why this is so. And as we read this, you're going to begin to see their arguments. This is why we believe, we are the ones that are looked to as the primary authority and power. Also, with regards to the claims of apostolic succession, this is Rome's rebuttal. This is their rebuttal. They're basically saying, hey, look, everybody knows with regards to pedigree, we can trace our roots all the way back to the apostles in Rome. So what are you guys thinking over there in Constantinople? You know, the only thing you have going for you is the fact that you had an emperor back in the 4th century, Constantine, who basically moved the headquarters up to Constantinople. That's it. But even with that, they still make an argument. Well, the emperor was wise, and God used the emperor. Now, guys, you can see this argument. God used the emperor in such a way, giving him visions. You remember Constantine said he saw a vision? He said he saw a vision whenever he went out to battle, and he conquered many armies. He said, God gave me that vision. And so now they're playing that card, saying, wait a minute. This isn't just by happenstance. God has given his blessing to Constantine to establish the empire in Constantinople. So therefore, this is the rightful place of power. Back and forth it went. Back and forth it went. So you gotta see what's going on here. Okay, who wants to read the next two paragraphs here, where it says further, and read that section where the quote is, where Constantinople has its own glory. So who wants to start there and read to that section right there? Who's got it? Go ahead, Sam.
Further, in time of danger, the churches sought a closer fellowship with Rome, taking the lead against heresy. The Roman bishop wrote letters attempting to promote unity among the churches, with the unfortunate result that his advice became authoritative decree. As the barbarian invasions began and the imperial administration broke down, the Roman bishop took over. The churches of Africa, oppressed by the Vandals, began to look to Rome for guidance. Eastern churches saw her approval also, but denied her presumed authority. It is clear also that prominent personalities in Rome contributed to the elevation of the bishop. Leo I, later called the Great, became bishop of Rome in 440 and served 20 years. He stressed the theory of Roman supremacy on the basis of apostolic succession. He taught that the Lord held the Roman bishop responsible for the care of all the churches, and that other bishops were assistants to the Roman bishop's administration, but could not share his authority. To the bishop of Constantinople, he said, Constantinople has its own glory, and by the mercy of God has become the seat of the empire. But secular matters are based on one thing, and ecclesiastical matters on another. Nothing will stand which is not built on the rock which the Lord laid in the foundation. Your city is royal, but you cannot make it apostolic.
Okay, so here we go, back and forth. So whenever you're beginning to look at his advice, look at the paragraph just right before you end on page 142, where it talks about the advice that that the Pope is offering, okay, or bishops, or the bishop is offering, you know, with regards to how to bring about peace and harmony, then that is looked at as a decree. You know, that this is something that is authoritative decree, it says. With regards to barbarians, that's something that you don't see going on behind the scenes. So there's a question had come up here not long ago about, when did Rome fall?
That's kind of a loaded question, because when you think about Rome, you know, with regards to her territory, my goodness, I mean, it stretched all the way to Egypt, to Britain. You know, it was a vast amount of territory, and it wasn't as if it was just one invasion like we saw with Jerusalem falling in AD 70. Boom, it was chipped away over time. Okay, it was just chipped away over time. But you do see the Eastern emperor, you know, around 479, basically being forced to release his power on his throne because of barbarians invading. And the reason I throw that out there at you is because you're beginning to see periods of time right now where, emperors are placing or hedging their bet. They're putting their voice and their vote behind whether it be Constantinople or whether you see, like Leo, for example, saying, hey, look, now this is the rightful place. Here's why. So keep these things in mind as we're looking at this. Let's look at this where it says Leo thus became the first pope. And let's finish this section out over on the top of page 144. Who wants to read that?
Go ahead, Zach.
Leo thus became the first pope. His claims did not stand unchallenged, but remained steadfast nevertheless. Weaker men who succeeded him were not able to defend these claims successfully. And after a period of ascendancy for the bishops of Constantinople, another strong personality became Bishop of Rome, Gregory I. It was also given the title of the Great, ruled from 590 to 604. At the close of his reign, the theory of the primacy of Peter and the Roman bishop as his successor and universal head of the church was definitely established. The episcopal order of government secured the submission of worshipers to a system of priesthood, the pattern set by paganism that priests were representatives of the gods and the emperor high priest had become customary in the church. The New Testament teaching that man may approach God directly was destroyed. The New Testament arrangement consisting of plurality of bishops in each congregation was forsaken. And while there were here and there sincere Christians trying to do the will of God as he revealed in his word, the eternal kingdom largely disappeared from the pages of history. That the development of a pope was gradual processing clearly seen is clearly seen. None of the apostolic fathers evidence such a situation. The
apologists
and the bishops of the early councils never had to reckon with papal authority. Christians today who respect the authority of the New Testament are forced to recognize the entire hierarchy as a human development, which is to be rejected in favor of the simple organization found in the New Testament, the last will and testament of Jesus Christ.
Okay, so when we, you know, look at our outline here, it says when invaders oppose territories, who was looked to for guidance? Rome still was, wasn't she? Okay, Rome was still looked to for guidance and support. Okay, and by the time we come to Gregory the First, who was Pope in 590 to 604, universal Pope was official and the priesthood was established, and it no longer, this was really hard to type and write this on your outlines, was the fact that it no longer resembled the first century church. It was gone. Okay, anything, if you were put in a time capsule and you were to go back in time and you were to go back to this period of time and try to find, as a whole, first century Christianity, it would look very foreign to you. But today, it would look very familiar to you. Now, that's very interesting. That's a telling statement, isn't it? That is a telling statement. And that is one that's why I personally believe that it is critical that we learn about church history. And we have discussions with folks, you know, not arguments, not, you know, in-your-face debate, but just discussions. Because I truly believe that there's just people who've been misled and they're just uninformed. They're uneducated on what the truth is. And when you have an opportunity to sit down and discuss with them church history, the very thing that we're talking about tonight, you know, you begin to, you know, the veil is eventually removed, okay? And you got a choice you got to make.
you know, and in your search for truth, you find New Testament Christianity. You find New Testament Christianity. Okay, any comments or questions? I've said a mouthful there. Go ahead, Imogen. I'm surprised you're asking a question. Go ahead. Oh, good point. Yeah?
Well, she's not my mother.
No, I know.
How does she arrive at?
Oh, that's a great question. You know what? When we get to one of the councils where there was a meeting with regards to how to elevate Jesus, not trying to just briefly answer your question, in an attempt, have you ever heard of the phrase unintended consequences?
Yeah.
You know what unintended consequences are, right? So in an attempt to elevate Jesus, they played the Mary is, you know, is the mother of God, okay? And that was that backfired, okay? Because it ended up being worshiping
Mary,
okay? Well, but that came about in one of the councils, okay? And there was an attempt, and they really try to emphasize Mary, the mother of God, okay? And with that, the intent was to elevate Jesus, but it backfired. It ended up elevating Mary. That's a good question, though. Any other comments or thoughts? Let me ask some of these questions that I had for you. What is your estimation of the Christianity from the first century until 604? You know, whenever you take it into this consideration, and so we've made our way up to 604 AD. Okay, so what is your estimation whenever you're looking at the first century church with the Bible knowledge that you have with regards to the organization, the structure? Let me just ask Pope. Do you see Pope in the New Testament church anywhere? We see it nowhere, do we? Okay, you don't see Pope anywhere. Okay, but we see it here, Dawn.
In fact, the Roman or Latin title for him was Papa. Are basically father.
Mm-hmm.
We have scriptural statement from Paul saying not to call anyone, any man on this earth,
mm-hmm,
father.
Yeah. Yeah, Jesus would tell us that. You know, you only have one father. God's your father. Okay, good point. Okay.
How would you have reacted to Constantine's involvement into the church? Okay. Here's a man, for all practical purposes, he's not a Christian. He's not a Christian. But boy, he sure is calling the shots. Okay, Dan.
Well, it's quite obvious that Constantinople put a stop to a lot of persecution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, if you're part of a church back then, I'm sure they seen that as a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was kind of hard to say, okay, well, we don't want him to be no part of it, but we sure like the idea that he's protected.
Okay, good point. So you see the dilemma, okay, where they have gone, the church has gone from being persecuted, hunted down like dogs, to all of a sudden, oh, now look who's in control, okay? Now, true Christianity would be humble and say God is in control, okay? God is in control. But, you know, at this particular time, we're looking at the 4th century, you know, 300s. We're looking at a time whenever the church is really at this point in time, they have, you're slip sliding away. It didn't take long, guys. You go back and you start looking at the 2nd century. You start seeing little pieces here, little pieces there, where the church is beginning to get away from her true identity as the Lord's church. So by the time we're here in the 4th century, with regards to Constantine, you know, but the church is still yet being persecuted, and you've got some that, you know, they're not going to bow down to wicked emperors, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, someone like Constantine comes into power, and it's like, wow, this is refreshing, you know? So it's tough. You got to understand that. Someone had their hand. Dale, did you have your hand up?
This time, they were being, like you said, they were being persecuted. They had no help, but then Constantine came along. He was dubbed as a friend of the Christians.
Yes.
Standing up for them.
Right, right. So what, how do you marry this in your mind with regards to him helping the Christians to actually being in charge of the church? Because he was. You understand what I'm saying? Go ahead.
If you go back to the scriptures, any time that the church was persecuted, it grew.
Yes.
And so in peacetime, it's when they got more, for lack of a better word, lackadaisical. You know what I mean? It's like, all right, you know, this is great. But then they get away and forget about God.
Right.
And start doing their own thing.
Right. Samantha.
Well, I was just going to say that if you go through and look at all of the different popes through the times, they actually almost became like the emperors of the Republic War.
They were emperors of the church. Right. That's a good comment.
Maybe not at that moment, but comes in and over with like this person who was saving them away from all of the bishops of Rome.
Yeah.
If you go through that history, I think it's Alexander the 16th or something, his family, the origins, is the basis for Mario Bruno, the God Father.
Uh-huh. Right.
So he's saving them against
Rome. Right, right. And you know, that's a good point. We're going to get into the invasions later with regards to the wars, the holy wars, the crusaders, and what have you. I mean, the crusades. You start seeing that unfold too about, you know, we offer an invitation. But, man, if they were to offer an invitation, they're going to put a sword to your head. You convert or die. So, Dale, did you have your hand up? It does, and that's what's going on. And, you know, this is the human element, I think, within people. This is the human element within people, is the fact that they lose sight of the spiritual life that God has given you, and spiritually who you are to be. Peter said, you know, we're a spiritual house. Do you know that? Peter said that in 1 Peter, that you are a spiritual house. And sometimes we lose sight of that, and we have a tendency and a propensity to fall back into this, you know, carnal. We're very earthly because we want power. You know, we want to be powerful people, okay? And that's what perhaps is going on here, you know? Another question. How would you have reacted? By the time we come to the 6th century, the church strongly resembled what we call Catholicism today. What have we studied thus far that would aid you in redirecting folks back into New Testament Christianity? Just some little nuggets before we move any farther. So you're having a discussion with someone who's in Catholicism. You know, based upon right now what we've looked at, because by the time we're at the 7th century, you know, the early 600s, again, the comment was just made, we'll stand by it. I'll stand by it. Is that the New Testament church is gone as far as what we're looking at religion. Now, there's always been a remnant. You know that, right? But as far as Catholicism has become the face of Christianity at that particular time. Dale.
If you look at the structure of the church and then look at the structure of Catholicism, it matches in no way.
Right. Okay, and it matches in no way. How are you going to prove that? Okay, thank you. All right, go ahead, Imogene.
Well, we get to see if gray smoke comes up out of the chimney or white smoke. I don't know. So, you know, they appoint a new pope.
They get together.
Yeah.
Yeah. The structure in the church is in such a way. Let's envision it like this, Imogene. You have a president and you have several little vice presidents. One of the little vice presidents is going to move up to become the president.
The vice presidents are called,
that's the best I can describe
it. They're called cardinals.
You're cardinals.
They're basically super bishops.
Yes. Do you understand that? You've got
pope,
people who are in waiting.
Cardinals, bishops, priests, and then us ordinary people.
Well, who decides that they get married?
Okay. Now, you know, we'll let them figure that out. Okay. With their councils, because I know that they're having that discussion now, you know, and along with other things as well, you know. But go ahead, Dale.
They
They take a bunch of cardinals, which are human beings, not a pope.
Yes.
They go into a room and they elect one of them, and that one man, they make him a god.
That's basically it. You know, that's it. Because his word, well, that's it. Because his word is divine. What he says goes. Okay? So don't be trying to take his rings off his finger whenever he's coming by and they smack you. So.
They were having troubles way back then, and they looked and he gave them direction as to how they should go to stay out of trouble and make things better for them. Start taking his word as authoritative.
That's
as
it.
Divine.
Right.
So now we're up to today.
Yes.
Where it is divine or appears to be divine.
And that's it. See, what they were doing was saying the Pope, well, this his advice all of a sudden is a decree from God. You know? Well, maybe you've been in this position before where you're having a Bible study with something, someone, you know, and in your discussion, I've had it told to me. You'll sit there and you'll show somebody book, chapter, and verse. And they'll look at you and say, but that's not what my preacher says. Now, haven't they basically done the same thing? I think they have. Okay. God is telling you this from his divine word. You need to believe. You need to be baptized. And you will be saved. Okay. Mark 16:16. Now, he tells us this. Okay. But then someone says, but that's not what my priest says. That's not what my preacher says. And they have elevated what their preacher says, what their priest says, above and beyond what Scripture says, what God says. Okay? So that was my question to you. What have you seen, what have you learned thus far that, you know, would help you better have a conversation with somebody? Because, you know, it's not just the fact, guys. I don't want you to just learn about church history, okay? This isn't church history class. I would like to call it evangelism, okay? Because I want us to learn it and know it. And God will, I believe this, we pray for opportunities. God will put us in situations and allow us to be a mouthpiece for him. I believe that with all of my heart. I know that to be true. And this is a part of being equipped and being prepared, okay? All right. We're going to move forward. Go ahead, Sharon.
That's the first thing we've got to convince them, though, is that the Bible is the authority. If they believe the Pope is the authority, then reading the Bible is not going to mean anything to them if you can't get them to believe that that's correct.
That is the very first step. You're right. That is the very first step. If we're just sitting here arguing opinions, we're not going to get anywhere. But you get someone to admit that his word, as Jesus said, will judge us in the last day, that it is the standard by which we are to live our lives. And I had an individual not tell me too long ago, and it just broke my heart to hear them tell me, you know, and minimize the authority of the Scriptures. Well, we don't know everything. Well, Peter says we do know everything pertaining to life and godliness. We do. And it comes through God's word, okay? And we see that, but you're right. That has to be where you begin. God's word is authority. Okay. Okay. Any other comments? We're going to move on. Okay. I just felt like that was a good spot to stop because we're going to start getting into the ecumenical councils at this point and watching and seeing, and we'll hopefully get our way maybe to where Imogen was asking about Mary, the mother of God. In her remarks. So let's go ahead and begin, guys, on page 145. Who just wants to go ahead and read two paragraphs for me there? Two paragraphs on page 145. Two paragraphs on 145. Zach, you want to run with it again? Thank you.
The term ecumenical means universal or worldwide. In extent, as applied to the church councils, it refers to the first seven councils to which all of the bishops were invited. They were held at Nicaea, 325.
Nicaea. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Constantinople, 381. Ephesus, 431. Chalcedon, 451. Constantinople, 553. Constantinople, 680. And Nicaea, 787. There were eight councils conducted at Constantinople in 869 that some count ecumenical, but is not generally considered to be so. Some Protestant scholars do not count as ecumenical any council after Chalcedon in 451. As by the time the Pope began to influence the decisions, on the other hand, in the Roman Catholics, on the other hand, the Roman Catholics claim that the Pope and Council guarantees their ecumenical character, and on this basis claim 12 additional councils are ecumenical.
Okay, go ahead and stop there, Zach. Do me a favor. I'm going to let someone else pick up on that paragraph, and if you could help me move to the next. I'm stuck on this slide right here. And if Melanie, if you'll go ahead and just take it up, these last two paragraphs right here for me.
A Christian who accepts the Bible as an inspired revelation from God can place no importance upon such councils because they're subject to error being human. Since the apostles, no man or group of men have been given the right to speak for God. Contrary to this, the Roman theologians maintain that the church as an organization does have the right to speak for God and that the bishops in council cannot err. The decision as to where final authority resides constitutes a vital difference between Romanism and undenominational Christianity. After the rise of the Pope as universal head of the church, there was a conflict over who had the final authority, the Pope or the Council. During the time we are considering, the Council claimed that it had the final authority, but later the Pope gained ascendancy over the Councils. After this development, Councils were seldom called. And when they were, their decisions would be accepted only if pleasing to the Pope.
Okay. Now it's becoming clear to you.
Uh-huh.
So what does the term ecumenical mean? It's universal. Now, I don't know how far in the weeds I want to get with this. But when we're talking about change within the church, and if you've been in the church more than a couple of decades, you probably are familiar with the ecumenical movement. Okay. Basically, when we're looking at the ecumenical movement within the church, we're talking about New Testament Christians, members of the Lord's church, branching out into fellowship and worship with denominational congregations and embracing them and saying, we be one, okay? We're all one. We're one big family, okay? It's universal, okay? And it's unscriptural. let me go ahead and just say that. Dale.
There was also a movement where a lot of the churches, well, one church said, you know, that we're going to support all the other ones, and if you have a problem, you come to us, as kind of the head of a group of churches, just like the Catholics were doing. And it was a movement to that, and they had to put an end to it because one church was not responsible for everything else.
Right.
Every other church.
Right. And it kind of history repeating itself just a little bit. How many ecumenical councils were there from 325 to 869?
Too many.
Okay. All right. H the official. but too many. That's a great answer, Don. Great response. Why do Protestants reject all the ecumenical councils that occurred after 451?
Ah, bingo, that's it. Remember what we were talking about earlier. Hey, look, you know, what the Pope says, you know, if you can, I mean, it was almost as if, you know, it didn't even matter to have a voice or a vote. If the Pope liked it, good. If he didn't, well, forget it. So why even meet? Why even have a discussion? You know, the Pope's running this meeting. Carl, were you going to say something?
You're explaining there, but I'm just having trouble that I see Protestants, when I hear that word, I think not Catholic, anti-Catholic.
Uh-huh.
And they're accepting the Catholic. You know, I just have trouble with that. I'm not understanding.
Well, they do. You know, you see the Reformation movement. We're going to get into the Reformation movement someday. When we talk about the Reformation movement, okay? And basically with the Reformation movement, you know, what you're seeing is basically kind of a twin sister to the Roman Catholic Church. You know, you want to make a comment on that?
Yeah, I think the critical thing to understand is from our standpoint, recognizing how far off the road the Catholic Church had run, we tend to think about the Reformation as folks coming in and trying to get it back on track. It's not.
Right.
The Reformation was started when Martin Luther, who was a Catholic priest, nailed up on the walls of a church in Germany, the things that needed to be fixed. He wasn't trying to create an alternative. He wasn't going back to Protestantism. He was saying the Catholic Church is right and has been right, but there's some fixes we need to put in.
Need to tweak a few things.
Yeah. And that's it.
Right.
So,
yeah. Oh.
Because the Reformation is not really a Reformation.
Not. That's exactly right. You know, it's not, but it's called the Reformation. And it's basically, again, it was an attempt to make some adjustments, some, in their minds at that time, some corrections to the church.
It was a flaw.
It was
fixes, but it was still, he still intended to stay part of the Catholic family. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of internal adjustments that he was talking about.
And that's why, guys, when we're talking about Reformation movement, whenever you start looking at some of the church's denominations today, and you ask yourself, Dale, I'm coming right to you in a minute, but when you start to see churches that mirror the Catholic Church, you know, a Presbyterian church, you start to look at Methodist church, and you're beginning to look at some things that kind of mirror that's what you're seeing, okay? You're saying, man, it looks awful similar to the Catholic Church, but it's not considered the Catholic Church. And it's part of that Reformation movement. Dale.
There's a difference between Reformation and Restoration.
Yes. And we'll get into that, too.
Reformation is
right.
The thing that we're after Restoration.
Right.
But a lot of the churches today, like you said, the Episcopal Church and some of the other ones,
yeah,
go in there, you'll swear it's a Catholic Church.
Right.
Because they're practicing the same things. But they don't follow the Pope. They don't know. We don't believe in that.
Right.
But the things that they're doing are exactly almost the same line as the Catholic Church.
Right. Yeah. It's still this. It's you're still getting. You know. At you're standing at the soda fountain. You're just getting a different flavor. But it's still soda. Okay. You know. So. But anyway. All right. So, you know, with regards to some of these other questions, why were councils seldom held at this time as time moved forward? Why were councils seldom held? Basically, same answer you just gave. It's the Pope. Okay. It is the Pope. You know, he's the one that's calling all the shots. You know, why have meetings? I'm a Jew.
What?
Now, I'm not going to get to Mary, Mother of God. You keep doing this. I'm just joking. Go ahead.
What is meant by a child
All right, Ron, you want to take a stab at that? You're former Catholic.
Okay.
And the happiest part of that was former.
The Catholics have sacraments. So they do the infant baptism. Then what they do is when you get a certain age, attending the classes, then you're able to take the Lord's Supper. And then you go back to more classes, and then that's when you reaffirm that you want to be a Catholic, which is essentially a confirmation. And they make a big deal of it, and the bishop comes out and anoints your head with oil and everything else. But it's sort of like that rite of passage into adulthood, or full membership in the Catholic Church.
Now, if you want to talk about charismatic movement stuff, come to me and I'll talk to you after class about it. Okay. So there's our first bell. So what's that?
Snake
tail. No, I didn't have that much faith. So I'm not a part of the chosen. I don't have that much faith. My question is, where do you want another door? Because I'm going to put a hole in the wall. So I'm getting out of there. Guys, so here's what we'll do. That's our first bell. And we'll go ahead and just wrap things up right there. Instead of reading the Council of Nicaea, we've already covered the Council of Nicaea, I think, up one side and down the other. But we need to look at it because it's here. And we'll discuss it. And we'll move forward. I apologize to Imogene. We didn't get to Mary, Mother of God. But I kind of gave you a little hint at what was going on there with one of those meetings, you know. All right. Thank you for your time and your attention. I appreciate it. Yes, sir. No, second week in March.
Welcome back. I'm seeing you, man.